Welcome back, everyone, to the Disaster Tough podcast, where we share insights into the big plays and right calls of leadership. We dive deep into the stories, lessons learned, and ideas that will help you in the field. Let's go. Welcome back to the Disaster Tough podcast. I'm your host, John Scardina. I am wearing my Portland Timbers shirt. Thank you, Portland Timbers, for the sweatshirt. My team was just on site. We had multiple days, site security assessments, walked the facilities, lots of interviews, qualitative, quantitative, the whole deal. Capstoning that with an active shooter training course. It was an amazing experience to work with everybody in the Timbers. I told you I'd give you a shout out. Just did. Man, I cannot thank them enough, but I also, I'm finding this problem around the country. Maybe you see it too, where people are just not aware of what can be done in facilities, right? And so huge shout out to the Timbers for saying, hey, we want site assessments. We want to understand coordination, collaboration. We want to understand how to work with our partners better. Their head of security, Jim, he's a former law enforcement officer, and so he really understands those relationships. But a lot of people don't. And so what I wanted to do was take a special opportunity to bring on an expert in organizational emergency management, resiliency training, the whole deal. Corey Smith, you're going to meet her in a second. She is like top tier everything. You'll hear a little more about her background, firefighter, Air Force. She works at Wells Fargo in resiliency and training. You're going to hear about that. And she probably has about 100 other things on top of what she's already shared with me. It's really, really exciting. So if you want to understand how to help out organizations in your community, or you're looking to get into organizational emergency management, definitely want to hear from her today. So without further ado, let me bring Corey onto the stage. Hello, Corey. Welcome to the podcast.
Hey, thank you for having me.
So most of people get this phrase wrong. They say a jack of all trades is a master of none, but they're wrong. A jack of all trades is a master of none, but better than a master of one, right, is the full phrase. And from a guy who's had lots of different jobs, who has felt that I have benefited a little bit from multiple different sectors, man, you are just rocking it in so many different areas, but you've had so many different types of career experiences. For the sake of our audience, just to get to know you a little bit, can you talk about kind of where you started in EM, especially with the Air Force, and then walk through like what your job is now?
Sure. So I started in the Air Force when I was quite young. I think I was 20 years old. And the recruiter told me it was the coolest job you could have ever, and it was Seaburn. So as you know, chemical, biological, radiological, nuclear, they said, this is like the coolest job that you can absolutely have. It's dynamic, it's, you know, front lines. And that's what I wanted when I was 20 years old. I was an adrenaline junkie. And it wasn't quite that. It was a lot of policies and procedures. writing down a whole bunch of stuff. And, you know, as an Air Force member, we totally earned our name sitting behind a desk, writing a lot of stuff. But it was a ton of fun. I really liked it. I got into the hazmat side of it, you know, doing the full hazmat technician, going down range. We got to work alongside firefighters and first responders, and I really enjoyed that career field. So I actually ended up switching after several years in the Air Force to doing aircraft firefighting. And again, adrenaline junkie, super cool, right? Helicopters, airplane crashes, you know, working with everyone, getting my EMT. And then that transitioned to doing that as a civilian. So working in a county fire department, helping people, and it was just a passion of mine. Mm. I will say, you know, working in those fields, I understood the importance of waiting on leadership to make a decision. You know, we're front lines, we're waiting on what to do during a disaster. And so that instilled me to kind of switch career fields again. So my husband's still in the Army. We have four kids, and being gone for 24 hours and him being gone and on deployments, it was just too tough to stay in the fire field. But I made a lot of friends, learned a lot of skills, and I ended up transitioning to working in local, state, and even some federal emergency management roles. And in that, I worked with public health preparedness, which was a unique set of skills. Looking at more of emerging diseases and what does that mean for our public health readiness, and then use those skills to work in state emergency management, focusing on exercises, which I then realized was really my biggest passion. I worked in an airport running their emergency operations, their communication center, their emergency operations center, basically the entire spectrum of emergency management. And I thought, this is it. I made it. Like most emergency managers, you know, when you start out, you're like, okay, the end goal in this career is not a CEO, but is the director of a county emergency management agency or maybe the state emergency management agency. Mm-hmm. I thought, this is it. I'm the director of emergency operations. But I was, I think, 30 years old. So I was like, well, what next? You know, like this is, well, what's next? Well, and I saw a job called, I think it was called like exercise and readiness or something. It was posted for Wells Fargo. I know, pretty cool. I do exercise. I have a passion for that.
Sure.
What does this mean for private sector? And luckily, the hiring manager took a chance on me. I didn't come from a financial background. I didn't come from another bank. She saw this unique set of skills and gave me a chance. And here I am today. So now I'm the executive director of Enterprise Resiliency Exercises. So for Wells Fargo, we're a global entity. And I oversee the global exercises. So we work with all the different countries that we have a footprint in and oversee all of our business groups and enterprise functions. And we conduct global exercises.
The L3Harris Extreme 400P radio solves problems and is specifically designed for emergency services. How do we know? We field tested it with medical, urban search and rescue, and collapsed and confined structures. This radio is amazingly tough. Check out the L3Harris Extreme 400P radio at L3Harris.com right now. If you served in the military, you've probably worn Proper Apparel. Proper Apparel is now reaching out to first responders and those who love the outdoors. Check out Proper Apparel from the outdoors to the EOC, wear proper. How do you spell Doberman Emergency Management? EOP, OEP, HVA, HMP, Thyra, TTX, Drone, PDA. Whenever you need an expert, Doberman Emergency Management field experts are there for support. Contact an expert at DobermanEMG.com today.
That's so cool. First of all, when you started in the Air Force, there's no way you could have known about this job now, right?
No, not at all.
And yet you just kept on like taking like the next step. So many people that I meet, gosh, they're like, hey, you know, they see me, right? Like CEO, or they see like these cool jobs. They hear about the people on the podcast. They're like, how did they get there? And you just, you know, kind of systematically walk through it as if it was like already planned. For me, it wasn't planned at all. Like,
right.
I just kind of went to the thing that was like, what is the most like exciting or most logical next step in my career? As an emergency planner, definitely didn't have a career plan that led me here. I don't know if you felt that way or not, but
yeah, not at all. I mean, that's the thing with this. It was like, oh, well, what are you going to do next? Or you have people that stay in jobs for maybe 20, 30 years. And I maybe it's the emergency manager in us, but we get bored unless there's something, you know, in front of us or there's some incident happening. And I knew that I didn't want to stop at a county or a state emergency management. I knew that there was more. And that was right when, like, I think emergency management was really becoming known in the private sector, you know, and they called it something different. They call it resiliency. And there's other like buzzwords out there that private sector uses, but really it's what emergency managers have been doing all along. We just need to network and know what's out there.
Yeah. And it's not always career stuff too, right? Like you mentioned, you have kids and you made a transition because of the kids. I did the exact same thing. Adrenaline junkie is definitely a good word for it or a good phrase for it. I loved being on the national IMAT. I loved deploying out to type ones and just like, you know, no sleep and exhausted and happy. I don't know. Just like it was fun. Just like traveling all over the place. And I wanted to be a dad. And so when my wife got pregnant with our first, I had always said that, you know, dad first. And I immediately transitioned out of that. But I also got lucky. Again, not anything planned. I was in an airport going from DC. We had a training in DC back to Sacramento. And I ran into an executive at Apple. And I had no idea he worked at Apple because my whole world was EM. Mm-hmm. And I actually knew him personally. He goes, you know, I work at Apple, right? And we started talking. And 17 interviews later in 3 months, I had this.
Only 3 months? I thought it would be longer.
Oh, gosh. Yeah, that was like the most brutal 3 months that I thought at the time. But I got a job at Apple, and you know, man, talking about total change. And it wasn't even EM, it was business intelligence. And it was like all the pieces of EM started lining up of like, this is what matches for business intelligence and data science. And then, you know, best worst job in the world. Love everybody at Apple. I love emergency management. I love helping out with disaster response and use that as a catalyst to do this now. And it's like, no one, that would have never happened, but I'm so grateful for the pregnancy. I'm grateful for the kid. I'm grateful for the career change, like all these things that led me here. And now you're hyper passionate about training, and you get to do it on such a an interesting and fascinating scale that so many people miss out on, right? And so for you, like in terms of like those 12 sectors that you're talking about and the global perspective, for like somebody who has no idea, right? Like that firefighter who's listening, that Air Force person who's listening in right now, most emergency managers, let's be real, what do you actually do in terms of your job? I mean, how do you, what are like the, I would say like the highlights of like what your job entails?
Yeah. So again, I think most emergency managers that I've met across the country, we're talkative people. There's never a stranger in the room. And so in my job, I get to interface with thousands of people across the company, and I get to understand, well, what does your program offer? You know, like, do you offer wealth and investment management? Do you offer a service? Do you offer a function? And then what are your risks? Okay, is it natural disasters? Is it cyber? Is it technology? Is it infrastructure? Is it, you know, people, protests, the economy? What is it? And then you write these plans and you understand, okay, if this were to happen, I would do these things. And my job is to make sure that you're actually ready, that if you say, I'm going to turn left, that you actually know how to turn left and that you can turn left. Or if you say, well, we would do nothing, is that the right answer? Yeah. And so I get to ensure that all of these plans make sense, and we exercise them. Well, sometimes they're in drills, sometimes they're in, you know, tabletop levels, but we do like full scale exercises that touch multiple countries at one time. Cool. Yeah, it's so cool. And I get to work with the coolest people across the globe that all have different passions. I've worked with prior, you know, three-letter agency folks that come in and they run a business, or we get to work with firefighters who are transitioning their skills, intel community. We work with the government still across, again, global governments. So yeah, I mean, it's really cool. I basically get to exercise everyone's plans.
That's awesome. You know, like we hate the idea of like bricks on a shelf, right? Like these plans that nobody uses. And like training is the easiest way to see if one, your plan works, and if it doesn't work, how do you fix it?
Yep.
And more importantly, like just to say like it had value, you know, you want your plan to have value. In terms of like your training perspective, I'm hyper curious, like, are you working like, I don't know, I'm just trying to keep it high level, but essentially like, let's say I'm assuming you're not focusing on like the, I wouldn't say standard, but like the bank robbery, the idiot who walks in and tries to steal like a grand and goes to jail for 6 years. You're like, you're looking at like a global perspective, right? And so when you're talking about like the natural hazards perspective, are you talking about like if a natural disaster impacts a sector of business, or are you looking at like sites? Does that make
all
sense?
All of it. So cool. We look at facilities, we look at people, and we look at functions. So, the way that in most companies that have a global outreach have to look at it that way. So they say, what functions do I do? You know, do we process loans in this location? Do I have a call center? You know, do I have this thing? And then I have these facilities, and the facilities could be maybe technology or infrastructure. And there's all the things we have to worry about. So again, in my program, we're full spectrum. So we look at natural disasters, we look at cyber, we look at physical security, vulnerabilities. And again, we're the exercise component of it, not necessarily the people that are enacting the rules, right? We work with them. Sure. And a lot of these different key leaders will come to us and say, hey, we need to have a more secure location here. We have a risk in this area. How do we go about that? And maybe our exercises sometimes are more proactive than reactive, where we do an exercise to identify the gaps.
Love that.
Yeah. Yeah. instead of the other way around, which is we wrote the plan, now let's exercise it. So we go both ways, but it's we look at the full spectrum of everything. And that's why we hire folks that come from an intel side or maybe a special forces side. And then we have the data analyst that's sitting on the same team going, well, the numbers say this. My team alone is super dynamic. We have skill sets from Air Force, Marines. We have a Navy guy, you know, they don't do much, but, you know, hitting for all the
things. Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
but we have, you know, data analysts, we have scientists on the team, and then we have people that come from an admin background that, you know, were never a first responder. And it creates this just dynamic team that's able to look at all these problems from different angles and come up with the best exercises you'll see out there.
I love that. We definitely need to integrate because we had like the same kind of concept. When you're talking, and by the way, I think we just figured out the name of our episode, Facilities, Functions, and People.
Yeah.
It sounds like a lot like you're both in a discovery and a testing of like hazard vulnerability assessments.
Mm-hmm.
When my company goes out and does it, we basically switch it up a little bit. We look at a quantitative and qualitative of impacts to sites, business continuity, and people. So like the same kind of idea. So in terms of like the Wells Fargo perspective and working within like the training realm, how does information get disseminated out once you're complete with a training? Yeah. Do you hand it off to each of the sectors? Is there follow-up? Like from an organizational standpoint, like best practice, what would you suggest to somebody who, let's say they got hired at some company X. I can't say X now because that's Twitter. They get hired at some random company and you're like, okay, my job is training. Mm-hmm. After I've done the training, now what? Like what would be your advice there?
Yeah, and just depending on resources, you definitely want a outside team, like not necessarily the exercise team, but a team dedicated to tracking those gaps, because then it's almost like they're the impartial viewers of the exercise, right? They get to see, oh, hey, this gap happened. They don't own the plans. They don't own the business, so they don't take it personal. They look at it from an objective point of view. And they take those and they say, hey, you know, you have this gap in your area. Do you need resources? Do you need training? Do you need funding? What is it that you need to help close this gap? And that team helps facilitate those leaders to close those gaps. That's what we've done at Wells, and it's worked phenomenally, where we kind of have a central area, a side team that we give these after action reports to. The stakeholders of the exercises vet the plans and the after action report, and they say, yep, we agree that gap was identified. So no one's blindsided. Everyone has buy-in, and this outside team gets to help track these gaps from identification to closure. And then we usually do an exercise the following year to see, okay, did that gap actually close?
That's awesome.
We have that kind of full cycle to the, you know, gap closure process.
So you mentioned your team. So I basically have a two-part question, and they're not really related. One, how big is your team? Like, what are the positions, quote-unquote, like the titles involved in your team? And then outside of that, what drives, I won't say what drives, do incidents drive the desire for training within the organization, i.e., if, you know, the bombing at AT&T on Christmas Day, does somebody, some exec say, hey, we need to do a bombing drill? Or is it more of like steady state, hey, we have this, we have a 3-year plan. How does the relationship work between that? Again, they're totally different questions.
Yeah, totally. Yeah. So my team is actually pretty small. There's only 12 of us. 13 and
3. That's huge. You have a 13-member team? Oh, my gosh. That's like 10 times larger than most. Oh, my team's pretty small. We have 12 or 13 people. Good gosh.
And they're all direct reports to me. So let me tell you, end of year reviews get pretty long.
Oh, my gosh. It's a beast of burden. ICS, was it 5 to 7 people is best?
I've been preaching that so much. I'm like, hey. And they're like, let's just hire more people. I'm like, I'm all for it. But yeah. No, so my team is incredible. Again, very dynamic. So we have different roles. Like one will be a lead facilitator. We have two data scientists on the team. We have within the like the lead facilitator roles, there's specialties. So again, my program is full spectrum. So we have a folks dedicated on physical security. Mm. We have folks dedicated to cyber resiliency. We have folks dedicated to international, India and Philippines. We have folks dedicated to third-party vulnerability management. We have another one that's dedicated to technology and infrastructure, cloud applications. You know, what does the cloud environment look like? And then we have one for business resiliency. So they all kind of, they're subject matter experts in their areas. And then they help conduct exercises, review plans, work with those business leaders across the organization.
Copy. Okay. So huge team. Huge small team. Sorry, if you're trying to get like more staff, oh my gosh, a super small team. They should totally let you hire more people.
Thank you.
Holy crap. Yeah, sorry. I totally played that wrong. Wow, you need way more people. And a contractor called Doberman.
For sure.
Yeah, copy. So you have your team. Mm-hmm. And now what drives the training? I obviously you have a plans piece, you mentioned that. But like so I get called it's a famous incident and it's public. There was a murder suicide at a University of California, Irvine. Mm-hmm. And my team does we essentially created our own application where we can do site assessments for physical security. Every camera, every classroom, every building, you know, the types of doors that we went through absolutely everything, but they call us after something like that happens and said, hey, we really need to make sure that we don't have somebody throwing off their mother off a top of a 7-story staircase, which is ridiculous, but it happened, right?
Yeah.
And how do you prevent it from happening again? And so like, how does that play into your world very much? And if so, how does it impact your like training schedule overall? Like,
absolutely.
You have to keep adjusting. Like, where are you at with that?
Yeah. So, we always like to have a 3-year plan, and that 3-year plan usually goes out the window within 6 months. But we like to have the 3-year plan, and we absolutely work. So, I'm sure you've worked with like fusion centers across the country, right? There's these law enforcement kind of intel centers where everyone from local, state, federal, they get to share intel. We adopted that model in Wells Fargo. We have a fusion center and we take input from the different ISACs. We take input from different local and state law enforcement and 3-letter agencies. And we have an intel section that monitors global activity. And then that drives, hey, we had an incident here. Maybe we're seeing this at a different organization or, you know, this cyber attack happened, you know, are we vulnerable? Just like I said, we talk about third-party vulnerabilities. We look at all of those. Where is our data being stored? Are we storing other people's data? Are we susceptible? Are we vulnerable? And so we have a 3-year plan of what we would like to exercise, who needs to have exercises, what capability are we focusing on that year? But we change depending on the threat environment. You know, everything's dynamic, everything's changing. So we're able to go, oh, we just had this active shooter scare. What are we going to do? Or, oh, we just had this cyber attack happen. What are we going to do? We need to make sure that we are, secure enough. So it's a little bit of reactiveness, but we also try to plan based upon previous incidents. And we take that data, hence our data analysts, and go, okay, well, we had X amount of these incidents last year. Let's make sure we incorporate that into our 3-year plan for future exercises.
Yeah, that's incredibly intelligent. The switching gears here a little bit. You mentioned something before we started recording, which I thought was pretty fascinating in terms of like the organizational perspective of, you know, you say the buzzword, resiliency. People who listen to this podcast, by the way, I harp on resiliency a lot. But just for everybody who's listening, there is a place for resiliency. I really believe in mitigation, but resiliency for sure.
Right.
There's complexities of organizational EM that people are just unaware of. And I will give one, and I'm sure you can dive into a whole slew of other ones. But just like the relationship between public sector and private sector, i.e. all the first responders, emergency management, even military, all those things. When we do a training and people only have public sector training, they'll say like, oh, I'll get the EMAC or I'll get this thing. It's like, you don't have that.
Right.
You have all this responsibility, none of the authority. Somebody will walk in, somebody else typically has standing, right? And like, so that relationship becomes very important to become like a diplomat, right? Mm-hmm. Like, just like, hey, I want to get the partners on here. But there's other complexities, and I'll tee you up on the grants thing, for example. Can you walk through, from a private side, the additional complexities of dealing with organizational EM?
Yeah, so in our world, we don't have the grants that like force people to work together. So we don't take federal funding and that says, hey, part of this funding is you will do an annual exercise with all of your, you know, county or state partners. We're usually just a silo, right? We're a big business in an area. And sometimes communities reach out to those businesses and they say, hey, we want to do an exercise. Our police force wants to come in and do a site survey, make sure we know if there was an emergency, where to go.
Sure.
That doesn't always happen. And so it is a little bit tough, but luckily our culture is incorporating more and more law enforcement and emergency managers into the private sector, and we bring those relationships with us. And so Wells Fargo has site management teams in our larger organizations that their duty is to reach out to local communities and say, hey, do you want to exercise with us? Do you want to come walk our facility? Do you want to know where the hidden key is under the rug so you can, you know, get into the building if there's an emergency? So it's a little tough. It's definitely something that a lot of private sector, technology, finance, we're all dealing, even some hospitals, you know, we're dealing with this day in and day out of, well, we do these exercises, but we just kind of glance over the first responders getting there, being on site, interoperable communications. Do your radios talk to my radios? You know, but we just kind of glance over that and then we exercise the rest of it sometimes. So it's definitely a challenge, and it's something that I don't think we have a solution for.
I mean, even public facilities, right? Like Navy Yard shooting, you think like, oh, it's a military compound, not really compound, but like it was a research facility, you know, multiple research facilities. We had something like 68 different channels that people were trying to use on radio comms.
Yeah.
Like it just was a crapshoot. And, you know, people think who they don't really understand organizational EM, that like sometimes like private sector does have additional complexities, as you just called out. But like anytime you're dealing with any kind of facility versus like a public awareness thing, man, things just go out the door.
Yep.
And it takes constant communication and planet's assessment for those who, by the way, just before I forget, want to work with those big companies in their community and want to do the site assessments. While the organization isn't going to pay for and or doesn't have the grants for you to show up, you can use UWASI funds, specifically in overtime pay and training, in order to get people there on a Saturday or get people there on a night. And so there are ways that the public entity can get grants for their staff in order to support you at yours. And sometimes it just takes like, hey, I heard that you guys just got UWASI funds. Fantastic. Use some of those training and come and play in our facility. And that might be a way to get people on board.
And so there was a community outreach program in RTI, the Raleigh technology kind of triangle, the Raleigh Technology Institute, but they have they kind of adopted it after the SARA Type 2 funding that's out there. They brought in all of the local companies in that research triangle park.
Yeah.
So all private sector and law enforcement and public came to there and it was the awesome best practice of like, hey, I know I can't talk on your radios, but your gate has this, you know, issue and it impacts us if we have a fire response or whatnot. And they planned exercises and who has funding and who doesn't. And, you know, I've never seen such an awesome organization just work together, bring in all of these entities, private, public, you know, nonprofit, to work together. I mean, it was like a monthly meeting. It was a great experience.
That's awesome. Yeah, it's the radio thing will always be a thing. The day I see an after action of a big incident that doesn't say communications, it's going to be like cheering in the street, just have a parade. I just like can't wait for like.
You can almost preload your AAR. Doesn't matter what it is, and just put communications as the first action item.
Yeah, exactly. Just the template of ChatGPT. It's like, for those who listen to the show, obviously a big sponsor of ours is L3Harris, and so I always like talk about the radios. But they sent me. This is how awesome they are, by the way. They sent me a Lego set for radios. So, I don't know. At least I can pretend that I'm talking to people.
Right, right.
Maybe that's what I'll do. If I don't want to talk to people, I'll bring the radio, the Lego person.
It's not
can't hear you. No worry. But either way, like, all this stuff, right? Like, every entity is going to have their own processes. There's mm-hmm. always personalities involved. There's always egos. There's different cultures. And that is already complex within the public sector. Now you're doing with the private sector. For me, when I dealt with the private sector, you might have a different experience, but getting buy-in from senior leadership was everything for me. Mm-hmm. Because let's be real, outside of you and me, people don't like thinking about disasters happening. They don't want them to happen. And they understand risk, and especially financial sector is great at understanding risk, especially financial risk. However, when you're talking about like death and destruction, people don't want to think about it. And if they don't want to think about it, they don't want to pay for all the extra things that are happening, right? And so how do you manage from a strategic perspective for anybody in the field, your advice at least on getting buy-in from senior leadership?
Yeah, absolutely. That doesn't change going from government to private, right? Senior buy-in is the key to a successful program. And you hit nail on the head. We don't save them money necessarily, right? We're kind of, we cost them money. But what we do to get senior buy-in is we give them statistics. You know, senior awesome. Leadership likes metrics. They like statistics. They like case studies. And in the, you know, financial sector, we like regulated papers like international white papers. And those are the things that we can pull from and go, listen, you know, for every dollar you invest into this program, you're saving six on the back end, right? You know, we had this amount of incidents last year, and look at the financial, the human factor, the facility factors, the penalties that we had because of this. But if we had put these mitigating factors in place, we might have been able to lessen that damage. And so we get their buy-in on that metrics.
So would you say that walking in there and saying you're an expert and you're following your gut is great for senior leadership? I'm so tired of the person who's like, they might actually be an expert. Usually they're not. But like the expert who walks into like a senior leader's office and said, well, you hired me to be the expert. And I'm just saying that tornadoes are important.
Right.
They're like, hey, man, we're in the. You know, we're in Vermont. What are you talking about? Like,
exactly.
You know, well, that's the thing that's going to happen. Cause it's like they need data. Like mm-hmm. data science is, and please correct me if I'm wrong, is probably the most undervalued and underutilized resource that emergency managers use. And it is the thing that would change their lives the fastest if they actually just implemented it.
Yeah, I have to give a major shout out to the data scientists on my team. Like I said, I have two of them, and we would fail miserably without them. I mean, they are a key resource to everything that we do. Understanding, we have massive amounts of data, but understanding the data that comes in, it drives goals. It drives preparedness. It drives resiliency. Without that data to know, well, where is our gaps, or you know, where do we have a concentration risk of functions or people or facilities? All that's in the numbers, and that drives, you know, senior leadership buy-in. It drives gap analysis. It drives future planning. Like I said, my team, luckily we hired two of them. You know, most exercise teams or resiliency teams focus on, do you have, you know, first responder background? Do you have the ability to, you know, go downrange? Do you have the ability to understand open source intel? What about the data, guys? And like I said, we were blessed with two of them, incredible individuals. Our team would not be successful without them.
Yeah, I can never go back. I have a GIS background, and so I basically had like a basic, I thought it was advanced, and then I got into Apple, right? Like an analyst perspective. No discredit to anybody in GIS, in emergency management. No offense, you guys have no idea what you're doing compared to like every other sector.
Right.
Like it when I got into, you know, to Apple, and I had to learn R coding, and I had to learn all these, like, oh my gosh, like my world was just like rapidly expanding, and I had a team with me. But even here, you know, we like focus on that. We met with the COO for Timbers. She's awesome. Her name is Ashley. She has a ton of passion to protect her stadium. But I can't go in there with just like, hey, this is what I think, right? And so our team would say, hey, like, this is like the risk by the numbers.
Mm-hmm.
Risk by the numbers, let that do the storytelling for you. Get a GIS-er, get a data scientist, and get an analyst on your team at a minimum if you have that capability anywhere you go, and you'll be exponentially better in your job.
Absolutely. And I say, you know, there's the emotional factor when you're presenting to senior leadership, right? If I say, well, my gut says this, or I think this because I'm the expert, it's almost like they throw up a wall and go, are you saying I'm not an expert?
Oh, right? I love that.
So instead I go, here's dumb, the numbers. Like you said, risk by the numbers, right? Like it's not my personal opinion. It's not attacking what you're doing or haven't done or should do, right? This is the numbers. And you as a senior leader get to decide our actions, and we support you based upon the numbers. I think it's very important when you're briefing senior leaders, political figures, that you take out the emotional element. And the way to do that is by numbers.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, I'm going to do a little bit of pushback on that, because the emotional factor is great to get buy-in initially. Mm-hmm. It's unsustainable though.
Okay. Yep.
Yeah. So using like real world incidents that happen now, i.e. the emotional side, we have to realize that in our field, like somebody else said it to me, he's like, everybody else's worst day is usually my best day.
Mm-hmm.
And unfortunately, that's just how it goes. But if you want to keep that up, like 3 months when that's not on the news anymore, what are you doing? Like those numbers
exactly.
have to help that.
Absolutely.
The other thing that's like really helped me out, I think, is just like avoiding negligence, like finding the wins that, because you're talking about like spend a dollar to save six, and that's really important. And then to like follow up with that, right? Of like, well, if you don't, not only are you doing that, but you've lost personnel, you've lost facilities, you might have to be doing lawsuits forever. Like it,
yep.
And worst of all, going back to the emotional piece, and you're doing it with a headache. Do you really want to deal with that? So,
yep.
I don't know.
Yeah, I would. So a lot of our BIAs now take into the reputational impact. You know, before I think a lot of it was contractual, legal, financial penalties. But what about reputation? What about our stakeholders? What are our customers going to say to us on Facebook? You know, that matters. So we take that into account when looking at our looking at our capability risks.
I've already kept you on here for so long. Everyone's going to give me so much flack if I don't ask you this question.
Okay.
Well, I actually have two last questions because I was finished with the same question. But from Wells Fargo perspective, huge company, 250,000 employees. You mentioned, you know, facilities as big as the Pentagon, right? Mm-hmm. Like, what are the exercises or what are the natural hazards, whatever, that you like focusing on the most? Like, if somebody wanted to apply as your 14th person, what do they got to know about?
Oh, that's good. So mine personally is cyber, because I think that threat landscape is constantly changing. Mm-hmm. And you always have to be on your toes. So it's going back to maybe my adrenaline junkie days. Like the IT vulnerabilities, the cyber vulnerabilities, that's a really good skill set to have. So if you are in the military, or if you are, you know, beginning your career, and I'm like, what's next? Technology will never go away, right? It's only going to get more complex. So getting that certification, getting your foot in the door, doing an internship, you know, understanding cyber and IT security and vulnerabilities is always a good career path. But for me, that's probably one of the most interesting aspects of this job. And one of my favorite exercises is always thinking about, well, what are the bad guys doing? What are insider threats doing? What are our vulnerabilities? What are our third-party vulnerabilities? Not only ours, but everyone else's. So there's so much to think about that, you know, keeps you on your toes.
Funny enough, Zach Forrest, who runs EM Weekly, did a tabletop exercise for TRL Insiders, I think it was 2 months ago, on a cybersecurity attack. And I had more people reach out to me saying, hey, I'm in emergency management. Why do I need to worry about cyber? And I was like, what? And so we had all this whole campaign about teaching EMs of like, mm-hmm. what happens if cyber impact? we really need to start catching up of real world problems, and technology is like our best friend. Everybody should embrace technology and at the same time understand the vulnerabilities of technology. So huge shout out there.
Absolutely. The vulnerabilities that we have, the ease of use of technology just leads to more vulnerabilities. I mean, look at industrial control systems in nuclear power plants. They're hooked up to the internet. That's a vulnerability, you know, like there's so many things out there that it's like, oh, it's so much easier now to monitor this, but now you're on the internet. Now there's a vulnerability.
If we lose cyber, then you and I are going to have to do this podcast on stone tablets or something. So last question, as I typically ask people, you've had such an amazing career. You're going to keep doing awesome things at Wells Fargo and potentially beyond, maybe here one day because you're an awesome trainer. But whatever that is, for those people who are starting out, like, what advice would you give to the people in the field, whether adrenaline junkies or otherwise, to help them find success in their career?
Yeah, I would say chase your passion, right? So for me, it was exercises. I enjoyed being a part of them. I enjoyed training. I enjoyed instructing it. And so therefore, I chased it and I found a wonderful career field. And I didn't let different, issues get in the way. I thought, okay, how can I tackle this? Private sector, getting into a huge, you know, multi-billion dollar corporation, what does that look like? And you just keep trying, keep applying, you know, keep updating your resume, keep networking, making sure that you're seeing what is the buzzwords out there, understanding what needs to be on your resume. And it doesn't hurt to reach out to folks on LinkedIn, get a mentor, even if it's uncomfortable at first, and say, hey, I know you don't know me, but I would like help. I want to get into that career field. And usually that's the way to understand, oh, this is the skill set I need. One of the things I used to do before getting into this role is I would look at the job postings of my dream job, and I would go down to the skills and competencies, and I'd go, oh, I don't have that. Oh, I don't have that. Okay, this is my 2-year plan. This is my 3-year plan. I'm going to get this degree. I'm going to get the certification. I'm going to do this thing. I'm going to network with these people, and I'm going to have that competency on my resume in a couple of years.
That's phenomenal. Thank you so much for talking to me about the facilities, functions, and people of organizational EM and what you do. I mean, you obviously have a passion for it, and following your passion, I'm the same way. I definitely didn't know where I was going to end up, and I don't know what the next 5 years looks like. But man, I'm having so much fun, and it looks like you're having so much fun. If you're not having fun in your career, if you're listening to this podcast and you're exhausted, you can do a couple things. One, take a deep breath. Everybody has hard days and hard months. That's just a part of reality. But keep updating your resume and network, like just like what Corey said. There is a webinar on the Ides of March with Pete Gaynor. He's been one of my closest mentors the last couple of years. It's been phenomenal. He has his own masterclass called Leading Through Crisis, where people can schedule time with him to get that mentorship, that those 30 minutes. And it's like a webinar where people can ask questions. So whether you get to listen to Corey on this podcast or hear that webinar or just tune in with us or go on social media and ask us a question, you know, what an opportunity to network and, you know, get out to meet new people. So again, thank you for listening. Corey, thank you so much for coming on the podcast. We got to have you back on and keep doing good stuff with you. Thanks again.
Thank you. I appreciate it.
All right, everybody. If you like this podcast episode, you got to do the things. You got to give us a 5-star rating and subscribe. Again, just like what I just said, if you have a question, comment, concern, anything you want to put out for the field, go on social media, LinkedIn, Instagram, especially we're on there, and follow us through the whole deal. And we'll see you for the next one. Peace.